Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We will, of course, talk a lot about the situation in Egypt and around the Middle East today. We'll do other things as well. But here's where we start. The Egyptian street is leading. The Obama administration is being kind of dragged along. Here's a brief audio chronology of U.S. government statements about the uprising in Egypt over the last week that we have put together. Last Tuesday, Secretary of State Clinton first tiptoed in behind the protesters.
We support the fundamental right of expression and assembly for all people, and we urge that all parties exercise restraint and refrain from violence. But our assessment is that the Egyptian government is stable and is looking for ways to respond to the legitimate needs and interests of the Egyptian people.
The Egyptian government is stable and looking for ways to respond to its people's needs, Hillary Clinton on Tuesday. Then Wednesday, as Mubarak's resignation became even more the focus of the protests, Clinton still framed it as an opportunity for him.
We believe strongly that the Egyptian government has an important opportunity at this moment in time to implement political, economic, and social reforms to respond to the legitimate needs and interests of the Egyptian people.
Then on Friday, the language began to get stronger and a little more threatening. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs.
We are monitoring closely the situation, as I've said. We will be reviewing our assistance posture based on events that take place in the coming days.
Reviewing our assistance posture. In other words, the White House was calling on Mubarak not to use force against his own people and warning that if force is used, the U.S. might reconsider the $1.5 billion that we send Egypt in foreign aid, second most of any country in the world, behind only Israel. And finally, yesterday, Secretary Clinton made the Sunday talk show rounds saying various versions of this.
I want the Egyptian people to have the chance to chart a new future. It needs to be an orderly, peaceful transition to real democracy, not faux democracy like the elections we saw in Iran 2 years ago.
So a chance to chart a new future, still not quite calling for Mubarak to resign. Clinton on Meet the Press. The U.S. has long walked the line of urging Hosni Mubarak to make democratic reforms, but not really pushing it because of Egypt's support for U.S. policies and fear of the alternatives, more populist, more nationalist, more Islamist. One of the most pointed images on TV this weekend was tear gas cannons shot off in Cairo, labeled Made in the USA, Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So what next for U.S. policy? David Sanger, the New York Times chief Washington correspondent, is with us, though his real claim to fame is doing the weekly Washington Report on our sister station, WQXR, every Monday morning, though I fear we've already missed this week's edition. Hi, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be back with you, Brian.
By way of background, why are Egypt and Israel, which are hardly the poorest countries or the biggest countries in the world, the recipient of the two biggest amounts of U.S. foreign aid?
You know, it all comes back to that moment on the lawn in the White House in 1979 when Egypt and Israel signed the peace treaty. The hope at that time would be that Egypt was paving the way for peace treaties like it with the rest of the Arab world. That has obviously not unfolded quite as people had hoped. And then, of course, 2 years later, the man who signed that for Egypt, Anwar Sadat, was assassinated right at the parade grounds and Tomb of the Unknown Soldier that many of the Egyptian troops have been surrounding today to keep the protesters at bay. But it is ever since 1979 that the U.S., whether Democrats or Republicans, have been sitting in the White House, has never quite known how to talk about freedom in Egypt or democracy in Egypt. Many have tried. Condoleezza Rice pressed with a very hard speech on the issue in 2006, and the result was that it took Mubarak, I think, 3 years before he showed up in Washington next.
Ross Douthat's column in the Times today reminds us of how our support for Mubarak with his police state was one of the root causes of 9/11. Ayman Zawahiri and Mohammed Atta, for example, having come from Egypt and learned their hatred of the United States via Mubarak's brutality. Douthat is a conservative columnist. Is that link to 9/11 accepted wisdom on both sides of the aisle in Washington?
It's not accepted wisdom, but I read Ross's column, and I thought he made a persuasive case. The case would essentially go like this, that because we supported Mubarak, that that created no space in Egypt for any other kind of serious Islamic opposition to rise up. And, of course, Egypt is where the Muslim Brotherhood got its start, what, 90 years ago or more, and is kept in as a, you know, very small and well-contained minority party. They can run, but they can never win. And the argument that Ross was making was that had there been a way for pro-Islamic groups to protest and even perhaps take power in Egypt, maybe 9/11 wouldn't have happened. You know, this is one of those what-ifs of history. You know, you have to then wonder, it's conceivable that you could have had an Egypt that fell into Islamic hands, and it could have become the breeding ground for either 9/11 or some other terror act. So it's a hard thing to know for certain. But it is for certain that what seemed to us to be or to much of America, to be a helpful calm in Egypt, an Egypt that was run by a secular strongman, may have, in fact, had significant radiating results that we're only now coming to terms with.
Listeners, we have an unscientific poll question on our politics website. It's afreecountry.org. The Obama administration's response to the protests in Egypt has been too little and too slow, too willing to throw our longtime ally Mubarak under the bus, or about right in a complicated situation. Register your answer at itsafreecountry.org and join the conversation there if you choose on the Obama administration response to the protests in Egypt. itsafreecountry.org. And David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, I played that evolution of administration statements from Tuesday through yesterday. What do you think we should make of that?
Well, I think the first thing that's pretty clear is that if Secretary Clinton could replay last week, I think that some words that she would probably not let come out again were the Egyptian government is stable and that it was looking for a way to go deal with the demands of these protesters. Clearly, it's not stable. There was a false stability that we saw over the years, and it took a while, I think, for the U.S. government to get their arms around just how false that was this week. But secondly, and I think the bigger issue, is that since this all began, we have seen no evidence that the Egyptian government has tried to reach out in any way to the opposition groups and try to go deal with them. Now, partly that could be because it is such a diverse group that, with the exception of Mohammed al-Baradei, the former Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, there was nobody really to go deal with who could do this, who could negotiate sort of on par with the Mubarak government. And it's not clear at this moment that he'll be allowed to. But it is interesting that all of the opposition groups, including the Islamists, who certainly are suspicious of Mr. al-Baradei, who is a pretty secular figure in the politics of Egypt, they've all begun to coalesce around him.
And listeners, we can take your thoughts on the air, too, about the Obama administration response to the protests in Egypt. What do you think about the action so far? What would you like to see the U.S. government do? And as we go along, we'll take your calls on other aspects of the situation. But right now on the Washington response, 212-433-WNYC, your comments, your thoughts, your questions for David Sanger, 212-433-9692. And we played all those clips of administration officials yesterday, even as Clinton was making the rounds on the Sunday talk shows. Mohammed al-Baradei, who seems to be emerging as, at least for now, kind of a consensus leader, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, formerly of the United Nations IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, expressing dissatisfaction with the United States, even up until yesterday, on ABC This Week.
He's also saying, I look to the government, you know, i.e. Mubarak, you know, to implement democracy. I mean, to ask a dictator to implement democratic measure after 30 years in power is an oxymoron. So they need to let go of Mubarak. They need to side with the people. They need to go for a transition, smooth transition through a government of national salvation. This is the only way out.
So what do you make of Al-Baradei expressing dissatisfaction with the Obama administration?
The central point that Mr. Al-Baradei makes, which is that you can't expect a dictator who's been in place for 30 years to suddenly decide that he's a Democrat who's going to run free elections, give up thought of running again himself, even though he's 82, or putting his son in place. It's sort of hard to argue with Mr. Al-Baradei's logic in that regard. So what is it that has kept the administration from just cutting loose from Mubarak? And I think the answer is that there are two fears here. One is the fear of a vacuum, that if Al-Baradei did not emerge as sort of a reasonable interim figure, somebody who the West could deal with, then the chaos that could ensue after Mubarak left would give Islamists an opportunity to get in and take advantage of this and perhaps hijack the process. So their one fear is an Iran-like revolution. And that's why you see the Iranians out there cheering on the protesters, because they think this is the moment for Egypt's government to come out of the secular camp and join them. What's the other fear that they have? The other fear is that whatever government they get, even a coalition government, would be much less enthused about supporting any peace process with the Palestinians and might come to question over time the peace agreement with Israel that was signed in 79. So they want to make sure, I think, in Washington, before Mubarak leaves, that there is at least a sense of an orderly process that would follow. Now, Mubarak's already called for elections in September, which we had all assumed would be fixed elections. If you could engineer this fast enough, there might be time, maybe, to have enough political life to begin to develop some real secular political parties who could be alternatives to run in that election. But, you know, February to September is not very much time. And as we've learned in Afghanistan and in Iraq, just staging an election doesn't mean much. Staging an election that actually can result in a government that can deliver services and have a coherent policy is another issue.
Again, to quote Russ Douthat's column today, and along the lines of what you were just saying, I think, history makes fools of us all, he writes. We make deals with dictators and reap the whirlwind of terrorism. We promote democracy and watch Islamists gain power from Iraq to Palestine. We leap into humanitarian interventions and get bloodied in Somalia. We stay out and watch genocide in Gulf Rwanda. We intervene in Afghanistan and then depart and watch the Taliban take over. We intervene in Afghanistan and stay and end up trapped there with no end in sight.
Yeah, it's not a happy list, but let me give you two alternatives that one might want to add to the list that did end up well, just to make it clear that not all of these transitions are a disaster, and that the two are in Asia. They're the Philippines and South Korea. In the Philippines, we were long allied with a dictator, Ferdinand Marcos. Eventually, the moment came to extract him. The Reagan administration helped do that, and they have an extremely messy democracy, but one that has been relatively stable. And while I used to go out and cover coups and coup attempts in the Philippines when I was a correspondent in Asia in the 90s, we haven't seen one of those in a long time. The real winner was South Korea, where you had a series of strongmen governments led by generals, not unlike Hosni Mubarak, who, of course, was in the Air Force. And over time, while some of the generals got elected initially as president, you've seen a series of good, stable elections where civilians have taken over as president. And the concept of a military coup in South Korea is a pretty remote thought these days. And the growth is phenomenal. It's now the 9th or 10th largest economy in the world.
David, stay with us. We're going to take a very short break. Then we'll continue with Chief Washington Correspondent for the New York Times, David Sanger. We'll start bringing in more of your calls. We'll play some more clips of Mohammed El-Baradei and look very specifically at what the choices are now for the Obama administration and whether there's a Democratic and a Republican and maybe even a Tea Party way to approach the crisis in Egypt. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and be sure to visit our Egypt 101 page at our politics website. It's a free country. We're gathering your questions about Egypt, less politics, and more your basic questions about the country and the players in the current crisis. We're collecting them now, and we will follow up with an Egypt expert to answer these Egypt 101 questions in about an hour. Also on our Egypt 101 page is our guide to the guides. There are lots of resources out there, and we've compiled some for you, links to guides from the LA Times, Al Jazeera, the New York Times, National Review, the BBC, Mother Jones, and more, and our own Twitter widget where we've collected tweets about Egypt and the protests all in one stream for you to track. Look for the Egypt 101 link on the homepage at our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. So we heard Mohammed El-Baradei before slapping the wrist of the Obama administration for being too slow to call for Mubarak's ouster, which El-Baradei says should be the first step.
Second step, we have to have a government of national salvation in coordination with the army. So the people and the army will get together, go for a transitional period, where then we prepare for a free and fair election, a new constitution, and then move on to a democracy.
Mohammed El-Baradei hoping to be the coalescing figure as we talk with David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for the New York Times. And David, should we talk about El-Baradei for a minute? I mean, you know, people, some of our listeners know his background, some don't. He probably won the Nobel Peace Prize, though they wouldn't have put it this way, for getting it right on Iraqi nuclear weapons before the war in Iraq. He and his IAEA at the United Nations came out and said there is no evidence that Saddam Hussein has nuclear weapons before the Iraq war. And then he won, maybe as a snub to President Bush. Then he got it right again, arguably, on Iran, where he was blowing the whistle on Iran being aggressive in trying to develop nuclear weapons and making strides. So what would you either correct or add to that little summation of recent El-Baradei history?
Well, some mild corrections. Somebody I knew well just from my coverage of nuclear issues over the year, and of course, you know, the biggest challenge that faced El-Baradei during his time was not only the politics of dealing with the Iraq invasion, but then the difficulty of dealing with the AQ Khan network, the Pakistani nuclear scientist who ended up providing designs and technology to Iran, mm-hmm. to Libya, to North Korea. And in the end, I think that the award, while perhaps tinged a bit by the anti-Bush proclivities of the Nobel board, was really for the emergence of the IAEA, and the award was to the IAEA, with him notably in the forefront of it, for their work in curbing proliferation at a time when we had just seen the emergence of the largest black market nuclear network in recorded history. So that was it. Now, then the question is, how aggressive was he? And actually, I think you could argue that Mr. El-Baradei, when it came to Iran, many believe pulled his punches a bit. And he pulled his punches in part because he feared that the Bush administration would, in its last days in office, mount an attack on Iran, much as it attacked Iraq. Now, that wasn't likely to happen. But as you could hear in his interviews this weekend, Mr. El-Baradei has got an abiding suspicion of Washington and its motives. And sometimes that's legitimate and sometimes it's not. But it is certainly a part of his makeup. And And it was probably aided by the fact that the Bush administration not only bugged his telephones at the IAEA, but tried to get him thrown out as the director general, in part because of his criticisms of them post-Iraq. So he has a pretty touchy relationship with Washington. And the result of that is that, you know, it's not necessarily clear that he's going to bring about the kind of transition that perhaps the White House would design if it had a vote.
Let's take a phone call. Brandon in Bloomingdale. You're on WNYC. Hello, Brandon.
Morning, guys. I've been following this for a little while now, and reading a little bit about how a couple of years back Israel had really pushed the idea of bringing an F-15s to Egypt as a U.S. sale. They didn't like it because they were concerned of Egypt and their relationship with them. Well, with this and ongoing political concerns, is there a tipping point where if Egypt's power goes one direction, whether it be the current regime and somebody replaces them or a new regime, is there a tipping point that Israel becomes concerned and steps up its timetable to address Iran's nuclear capabilities? Do you think that, you know, the concern of a war on two fronts might push Israel to go ahead and you know, address the Iranian concern?
David?
A very good question. I don't think we're anywhere near that right now, in part because we've put some time on the clock when it comes, as the administration says, when it comes to the estimates of how long it would be before Iran got a weapon. So some combination of sanctions and covert activity, including Stuxnet, the computer worm, have slowed the Iranians down. So the Israelis have been a little more calm in recent times about the Iranian program than they were, say, a year or a year and a half ago. But that doesn't mean that they aren't deeply worried about what could happen in Egypt, because Egypt has long been both their ally and buffer zone, or at least peace partner and buffer zone here with the Arab world. And if it did look like Egypt was heading closer to the Islamist camp, they would be quite concerned. My guess is we won't see that or know that for quite some time.
And El-Baradei, in that same interview on ABC yesterday, said he thinks the Islamist camp, or at least the Muslim Brotherhood organization, only has about 20% support in the Egyptian population. So if there was to be a real, you know, civic, secular, democratic election in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood would not take power. Maybe they'd be about 20% of a coalition. Is there any reason to believe that or to doubt that?
No, I think his numbers were about right. But as we've learned in other places in the world, notably Afghanistan, if you have a either a violent or a quite determined minority, as the Taliban is, even if the Taliban are widely hated in many parts of Afghanistan, they can have an oversized amount of influence. And so while the 20% is true if you're running a real free and true election, it's not entirely clear what the politics of Egypt might look like. And it's hard to know because the place hasn't had real politics in 30 years.
Right. And what about this from an Israeli perspective? Even if it doesn't become a post-revolutionary Islamist state like Tehran did when the Shah was overthrown, if it becomes a secular democracy, is there much reason to think that an elected Egyptian government would either maintain the peace treaty with Israel or break the peace treaty with Israel based on the popular will?
My guess is that they would probably maintain it unless there was an overwhelming change in the politics. But it becomes a much harder thing to predict, because what people will say as they are running for office and what they have to do when they actually have to govern a country, and they're thinking about the kind of aid they get, and they're thinking about the arms, and they're thinking about the relationships in the military. I mean, the factor we haven't discussed here, Brian, is there is no military in the Arab world that is more entwined with the United States, more trained by the United States, more equipped by the United States than the Egyptian military. And, you know, it's one of those arguments that people would make in favor of having these deep military-to-military relations that frequently we cut off when we see, you know, human rights abuses and so forth. But in the past week, quietly, American officers who have trained with their Egyptian officers here in the United States or been over there have had a chance through email, through phone conversations, to sort of send a moderating message. Hey, don't open up fire on these protesters.
And at the same time, we saw those images on TV over the weekend of some tear gas canisters that were fired and did land. And what did they say on them? Made in the USA, Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
That's right. But better tear gas canisters than bullets. And, you know, in South Korea, when I used to cover the transition to democracy there, there was a lot of tear gas in the air, and it was pretty nasty stuff. But in the end, tear gas canisters apart, and some of them probably were also made in the U.S. or its allies, you ended up with a democracy. So have we armed the Egyptian military? Absolutely. Has the Egyptian military shown a fair bit of restraint to date? Doesn't mean they will tonight or tomorrow, but to date, yes. And I suspect that that's partly related to the training.
David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, with Phil in Queens. Phil, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. I had a comment and a question. My comment is that it seems that once again, the Obama administration and even perhaps Hillary are still on a learning curve. Hillary really didn't have that much foreign affairs experience, and Obama had very little experience of any kind. It seemed like he took about 5 days to make any decision. And related to that, I'd like to ask the experts if McCain had been president, would the Arab street be rebelling in any of these countries today?
And Phil, before you go, is there anything in particular that you would like to see the Obama administration do, or do you think that they should have done differently over the last week?
Well, I think that this is an opportunity to both keep control and pressure the powers that be to moderate and democratize and keep a secular state there. I hate the notion of America ever supporting any dictators. And it's been, you know, after the Cold War, it was the situation where we supported dictators all over the world. But we should have always been pressuring them to educate their people, to modernize their countries, and to become modern, successful mm-hmm. states. And instead of just giving them money, and then all the dictators either get shot in the head or they retire to the south of France. So I would like for Obama to say to him, listen, we need you for a year or two. Let's transition. Here's your bank account so you can go to Antibes in 2 years with mm-hmm. your family. Mm-hmm. And let's create a modern state. The Egyptian people, I know many of them, I have a relative who's Egyptian, need to be given this opportunity.
Phil, thank you very much. I don't think they have a year or two with Mubarak the way things are going. But David Sanger, his question to you really was, do you think things would have been any different if McCain had been elected president?
Well, I don't believe that you would have seen a McCain administration, it's hard to know right now, separate itself from Mubarak any faster than President Obama did. Did the Obama administration seem behind the curve last week? Yeah. When the long history of this is written, is 4 or 5 days going to make that big a difference? Probably not. I'm sure that, you know, the Reagan administration seemed behind the curve on Marcos. Where your caller ended up, though, was saying that he wanted the administration to manage Mubarak through a transition out. And I think you made the right point. We probably don't have a year and a half for that. We may not have a week and a half. We might have a month and a half.
You might have, not maybe have a day have, and a half.
Maybe we have to the end of the year. Who knows? I mean, you know, Mubarak is nothing if not a survivor, but it's hard to see where he's going to get the support right now to stay in. But I think the administration was coming out pretty close to where your caller was coming out, which is that what they want to do is get a smooth and stable transition and not a descent into chaos. And, you know, in the end, we don't get to decide here. You know, all we get to do is use whatever levers of power the United States has to try to manage a transition. But I think that it's pretty clear that the United States as a country, you know, this isn't about us.
Are there partisan differences on what to do now? I saw McCain on CNN yesterday, followed by Chuck Schumer, and they seemed to basically agree with each other, and they both supported the president. McCain did, in so many words, in threatening the foreign aid but not quite calling for Mubarak to resign. Are there any divides? Is there a Tea Party position? Is this a partisan issue in any way right now?
I have not seen any divides. I mean, the Tea Party, we haven't seen much of a foreign policy, period. What little we have seen has been sort of a sort of more pullback, if not isolationist sort of tendency. But on this issue, I haven't heard them at all. You know, this is at a, we're at a moment right now in the Egypt issue where this isn't about the ideology of how much you do democracy promotion or not. This is a question of, if a transition is underway, how does one make it the least violent? And I think that's why you're not hearing much space between, say, the McCain camp and the Obama camp.
David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Thank you so much. Very, very informative, David.
Thank you, Brian. Always good to be with you.
And you classical music listeners, you can hear David on Monday mornings on our sister station, WQXR, with his weekly Washington Report. And don't forget, we have an unscientific poll question on our politics website. It's a freecountry.org about the Obama administration response. The question is, the administration response to the protests in Egypt has been too little and too slow, too willing to throw our longtime ally Mubarak under the bus, or about right in a complicated situation. Register your answer at itsafreecountry.org and join the conversation there if you choose. And when we continue in a minute, we'll talk to Egyptian-born blogger Mona El-Tahawi, who was with us last week. We'll get her take on what's going on. She's in very close touch over there. And we will go to the region and talk to a guest from Global Voices Online in Bahrain who monitors social media coming out of the entire region. Stay with us.